state lawmakers released their report on Governor Sarah Palin's conduct in the firing of Walt Monagan. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 10th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Navy historians officially identify the remains of a World War II submarine that sank off the Aleutian Islands in 1941. The sons of the captain helped locate it.
It's just kind of like winning the lottery 20 times in a row.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alaska Railroad Corporation, with daily rail service to Seward, Whittier, Anchorage, Talkeetna, Denali Park, and Fairbanks through mid-September. Information available at alaskarailroad.com.
Hordes of international reporters waited more than 7 hours today for the release of the investigator Steve Branchflower's highly anticipated Troopergate report. After carefully reviewing the contents of the 200-page document, the Legislative Council voted unanimously to release it to the public. APRN's Ellen Lockyer is at the Legislative Information Office in downtown Anchorage, where today's closed-door meeting took place. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, Lori.
Ellen, I know that you've had a short time to look through the report. What's the main message?
The main message is finding number one, that the Branchflower finds that Governor Sarah Palin abused her power by violating Alaska Statute 39.52 of the Alaska Executive Branch Ethics Act. Now, this is a statutory violation, I would assume.
And Ellen, did Branchflower's findings say Palin's actions were unlawful or unethical?
Well, it doesn't spell that out in so many words. They're very, 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 precise. It says the Alaska Executive Branch Ethics Act. However, it is an Alaska statute, therefore it would be unlawful. And as Kim Elton was saying, there is an extremely rigid definition of, what an executive can and cannot do.
Does the report conclude the dispute over Trooper Wooten was the only reason Public Safety Commissioner Monagan was fired?
No, that is finding number two. Although Walt Monagan's refusal to fire Trooper Michael Wooten was not the sole reason Monagan was fired by Governor Sarah Palin, Branchflower finds that it is likely a contributing factor to Monagan's termination as Commissioner of Public Safety.
Ellen, have you had a chance to talk to any of the lawmakers who were there?
Yes, I have. I just want to add one more thing. In spite of the fact that the Branchflower finds that there was more than the firing of Monagan was probably triggered by this refusal to fire Wooten, Branchflower also finds that the governor's firing of the Commissioner Monagan was a lawful exercise of her constitutional and statutory authority to hire and fire executive branch department heads.
And what are lawmakers saying that you talked to today?
Well, I talked to Lyda Green, and she is, of course, one of the legislators that called for this investigation in the first place. Lyda Green called the report soft, and when pressed to explain why she thought it was soft, you know, there was this, it's her opinion. And as far as what's next, I asked her that, and she said that is ambiguous because apparently if the legislature takes action now, they have to do it this session, and then they'd have to go back into special session.
Did you talk to anyone else?
Yes, I talked to Kim Elton. He says he totally agrees with the findings, and that Kim Elton told me that this is now a matter for the executive branch.
And did you get any sense of what happens from here?
That is my big question, and I did ask that of two or three different people. It is a little murky from here because, as Kim Elton told me, now the matter is out of the Legislative Council's hands. Now it moves somewhere else. Where else it will move right now is the question.
All right. Thank you, Ellen, for that update.
Okay. Thanks, Lori.
APRN's Ellen Lockyer reporting live from the Legislative Information Office in downtown Anchorage. A A judge today has ordered Governor Palin not to destroy any personal emails having to do with state business and to ask her internet provider, Yahoo, to try to retrieve any deleted ones. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
Nobody is saying how many such emails there may be, but it is well known that the governor and her inner circle stay in close touch by handheld internet devices. The state law department says messages about state business are no longer traveling into private email accounts, and the administration will try to retrieve, or as the judge put it, resurrect, any that did in the past. It may be a while before the plaintiff sees them. Andre McLeod, a Republican, asked for the order after requesting and obtaining some of the governor's emails sent through the state system. One email exchange made her suspicious that there might have been a pattern of back-channel communication in the administration about sensitive matters. It was dated February 7th. Frank Bailey, the governor's director of boards and commissions, sent the governor an email saying that 10% of Palin's appointees were Alaska Native. An email shot back from an aide named Donna saying, quote, "Frank, this is not the governor's personal account." Bailey responded with a single word, quote, "Whoops!" exclamation point. McLeod's lawyer, Don Mitchell, says he'd very much like to put Bailey or Donna under oath and ask them what that exchange meant. State Superior Court Judge Craig Stowers ordered the administration not to destroy any emails conducting state business on the governor's personal email account. That Yahoo account was subsequently hacked into and a screen from it was published. It indicated a number of subject items that appear to involve state business. One newspaper has reported the governor also had another email account. The judge stopped short of requiring emails to be archived in the state system, but he said he would hear arguments on that next week. Don Mitchell said he was not seeking an order to bring thousands of personal emails into the courtroom for the judge to determine which are state business, so the governor gets to decide what in the old emails is not personal and cannot be destroyed. There are now dozens more public records requests pending, and Judge Stowers said he was clearly aware that this case was breaking new legal ground. He said he was up early today and couldn't sleep, so he researched the growth of the Internet. He said the last time the Public Records Act was amended was in 1990, and almost all of the Internet's growth has taken place since then. Plaintiff's attorney Don Mitchell said, as far as he can see, the law still clearly applies to any state business, regardless of the system of communication. Assistant State Attorney General Mike Mitchell argued that because the law spells out that it only applies to records that are retained, he's not sure it's applicable to deleted emails. Judge Stowers said, quote, "Do you really think it disappeared completely and forever?" And indicated he would go behind closed doors and sort through as many emails as were put before him if that's what it took to resolve the case. It may not come to that. Assistant AG Mike Mitchell appeared to be eager to get into settlement talks with plaintiff's attorney Don Mitchell. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a promising technology that could provide cheaper fuel in the interior.
This is on track to create a heating fuel available to Fairbanks residents in the $2 range.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
9 out of 10 of Alaska's boating fatalities are adult males. Most drowned following an unexpected fall or capsize into cold water. Cold water can kill the unprepared, regardless of swimming ability. Wearing a life jacket can make the difference between life and death. Make your family's boating memories good ones. Always wear a life jacket when boating Alaska's cold water. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Former Secretary of State Colin Powell says Alaska Senator Ted Stevens' reputation for integrity and truth is sterling. The four-star general testified today as a character witness in Stevens' federal trial. Alaska's senior senator faces 7 felony counts of lying on his financial disclosure forms. APRN's Libby Casey is covering the trial in Washington. Hi, Libby.
Good evening, Lori.
Libby, what was the reaction in the courtroom when Powell testified on Stevens' behalf?
Well, this is the most impressive character witness who will testify during the trial, and the jury responded to him. They were smiling and glancing around when he took the stand. It was a little more electric in the room, and they seemed to relate to him. Powell talked about his youth growing up in New York's South Bronx and going to public school, and I saw one juror nodding as he talked. Powell was the first African-American Secretary of State, and 12 of the 16 jurors and alternates are themselves African-American. So the defense is likely hoping he impresses and speaks to the jurors. Powell talked about his time as National Security Advisor in the 1980s and described spending late nights with Ted Stevens on Capitol Hill working for the country's defense. And it almost sounded like a campaign stump when he said Stevens, quote, fights for his state and fights for his people and keeps the best interests of his country at heart. And Powell said, in infantry terms, Stevens is the kind of guy you want to take on a long patrol. When it came time for cross-examination, prosecutors only asked Powell if he'd ever visited Stevens' home in Girdwood, Alaska, and if he had any personal knowledge of the case. And he answered no to both.
Well, yesterday jurors heard from Hawaii Democrat Senator Daniel Inouye as a character witness. Was Powell the only character witness today?
Yeah, the defense said it wants to call 11 character witnesses, which is a lot. So the judge has limited them to 5. They'll decide who else to pick from their list next week. But a handful of people who testified today sort of tried to vouch for Stevens or be unofficial character witnesses, and they were stopped by the judge when their testimony veered toward cataloging Stevens' accomplishments in Alaska. Julie Kitka, who's the president of the Alaska Federation of Natives, was there to show that Native corporations compete against VECO for contracts. Now remember, Stevens is accused of taking gifts from VECO. And Kitka said that Stevens is responsive to Native corporations. But she would start talking, however, at times about the history of Native land claims and Stevens' role in them, and the judge would cut her off and have her stick to her point. Two labor leaders, Mano Fry and Jim Sampson, testified that VECO was a non-labor employer and often fighting them in union interests, but that Stevens was, in their opinion, pro-union in his legislation. And then a doctor from Alaska said that Stevens, quote, helped her save a baby, and that's why she was testifying. Well, that sort of brought things to a halt for a few minutes because she really had to limit her comments to answering questions. You know, there can't be a stated agenda in testifying. Her purpose was to be there to show Stevens was responsive to her when she came to him as a constituent asking for help with a medical situation, helping to get a child medevac to the lower 48. So these people were sort of trying to show their loyalty to Stevens, but I don't know how, that probably came through to the jurors somewhat, but a lot of that didn't actually make it onto the record.
Libby, one of the gifts Stevens is accused of taking is the renovation of his Girdwood house. How are his attorneys fighting that?
Today, some contractors testified, people who were promptly paid by Stevens' wife to work on the house. Robert Redman did dirt work, and Tony Hanna raised the house so a first floor could be built underneath. The defense says Stevens and his wife paid $160,000 for this major renovation and thought that covered the cost. But the prosecutors say the project cost more than double that, and employees of VECO actually did much of the labor and paid for materials. We also heard from house appraisers and assessors today about just how much the house was worth before and after the renovation, and the defense is trying to show Stevens would not have expected the construction costs to be so high.
All right. Thanks for that update, Libby.
Thanks, Lori.
APRN's Libby Casey is covering the Stevens trial in Washington. The remains of a World War II submarine, the USS Grunion, have been officially identified by Navy historians. The sub sank near Kiska in the western Aleutian Islands on August 30, 1941. The captain of the ship, Jim Abele, left behind his wife and 3 young sons. But the sons didn't give up their quest to know what happened to their father. KUCB's Ann Hillman has more.
When the Navy announced they officially identified the remains of the USS Grunion, Bruce Abele and his brother weren't surprised.
You know, from John and I, you know, it was like the most obvious thing in the world. And you know, nobody has to tell me that because they say it's the Grunion that I believe it. I believe this whole world. There's no question about it.
They had organized and funded the trips that identified the submarine near Kiska Island, where the Japanese had a base camp during World War II. Abel Lee says the Navy's recognition just gives credibility to the find they made in 2007. The Abel Lee's quest to find their father's ship was a string of improbable events.
It's kind of like winning the lottery 20 times in a row.
A man found an old Japanese ship diagram in an antique shop, then posted it on the internet years later, looking for authentication. A Japanese man saw it, knew which ship it was, and said he also knew what happened to the Grunion. The Abel Lees found the Japanese man, who told the story of his cargo ship exchanging fire with a submarine near Kiska. Abel Lee says it's unclear if the cargo ship hit the Grunion, but shooting off six heavy torpedoes could have thrown the sub off balance.
To lose control of the depth control, and nothing to do with the enemy at all, and that may have been what happened.
After hearing the story, in 2006, the Abel Lee brothers sent a ship to the area where the Grunion would have gone down. Side-scan images told them something was there, but experts told them it wasn't a sub. The brothers ignored them and returned to the area in 2007 with equipment to take better photos. That was the evidence used to prove that they had truly found the Grunion. Now, Abel Lee is working to continue the mission his mother began the day she found out that the submarine went down.
At that time, you know, my mother was left with three small children. I was 12, my middle brother was 7, and John was 5, and he had no means of support. And yet she managed to sit down and hand write a condolence letter to every single one of the next of kin.
66 years later, Abel Lee is organizing a memorial service for all of the men who died on the Grunion. It will be held this weekend in Cleveland, Ohio, and part of the Grunion will be there too.
What happened is when a sub goes to battle, you take the bell off because of all the things you don't want is noisemakers on a sub.
The bell, which is considered the soul of the ship, ended up in a dumpster at Pearl Harbor before being taken to Grenville, Mississippi. Someone saw it and sent a picture to Abel Lee. In order to borrow it for the ceremony, they had to cut it from the stand with a blowtorch. Now, the bell will toll this weekend to honor those who were lost.
And then what the tolling of the bells does is it reaches out to all of the 52 subs that were lost and the 3,900 men that were lost. And that's big stuff.
Abel Lee says close and distant relatives of those lost in the Grunion have already made plans to attend the service. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing personal attention from people who live and work right here in Alaska. Wells Fargo, the next stage. Support for APR and coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood comes from the Alaska Sea Life Center, Alaska's unique marine research facility and public aquarium.
This week on AK, buried treasure. We'll dig up clues to the past and rebury some, too. Plus shipwrecks, fool's gold, and buried hand grenades. All that and more this week on AK.
A report shows coal-to-liquids technology could provide cheaper fuel for Fairbanks. A Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation commissioned feasibility study done by Hatch Engineering of Canada is out in draft form. Fedco CEO Jim Dodson says the preliminary document needs some tweaking, but that overall it's optimistic about local coal-to-liquids potential.
It's not an on-the-ground engineering report. In other words, it's kind of a view from 10,000 feet. But, you know, having said that, the overarching report appears very positive. And I think it'll even improve when we are able to, you know, get the errors cleaned up.
Dodson says the document uses coal and transportation cost estimates that need to be adjusted. But assumptions aside, it shows use of Fischer-Tropsch technology to turn local coal into a liquid fuel would be more than economically feasible.
We believe from this initial report that if this becomes a project, this is on track to create a heating fuel available to Fairbanks residents in the $2 range.
Dodson says Fedco is in the process of providing more accurate input for Hatch for a final version of the report due out later this month. Dodson says construction costs are estimated at $2 billion to $6 billion, depending on the size of the coal-to-liquids plant. The facility would also produce transportation fuels, including jet fuel for the Air Force, which is mandated to begin filling some of its fuel need with non-petroleum sources. The state House race for District 29 in Anchorage has taken a legal turn as the Republican Party is protesting the right of the Democrat candidate to run. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
On September 25th, the Alaskan Republican Party protested Chris Tuck's candidacy for House District 29 to the State Division of Elections. The party questions his residency and his name, saying he's legally Christopher Scott Mestis. McHugh Pierre is spokesman for the Alaska Republican Party.
You have to live in your district, and you have to be a voter in Alaska, and that means you file by your legal name and you're a registered voter. Well, Mr. Mestis is not a legally registered voter in Alaska, and it's questionable where he really lives. It seems like he truly lives in District 28.
District 29 became vacant when Republican incumbent Ralph Samuels decided not to seek re-election. Ron Jordan filed as the Republican candidate, and originally Bronson Fry as the Democrat. Fry withdrew, and on September 17th, Chris Tuck, a Democrat and member of the Anchorage School Board, registered. Pierre says a week later, the Republican Party submitted its candidacy protest to the Division of Elections. They also charged Tuck with voter fraud for not using his legal name. Tuck says, first of all, the District 28 address the Republican Party cites is his mother's.
I live at 8220 Barnett, but I oftentimes use my mom's address for mailing and everything because she sorts through my mail and does my mail stuff for me.
But he adds his school board phone and computer server are set up at his Barnett Drive apartment, which is in District 29. Tuck says he's collecting neighborhood confirmation and other proof of his residency for the Division of Elections. He adds the Republican Party also disputed his address when he ran for the same House seat 4 years ago. The Division of Elections director, Gail Fanumiai, says residency disputes are common. She has a considerable number of precedents she can use for guidance. Plus, the division works closely with the State Department of Law. But the name challenge is a new one. Fanumiai can't find any cases where the commonly used last name of the candidate doesn't match the legal one. Pierre also points out on his Alaska driver's license Tuck is Christopher Scott Mestis, and that he's received his permanent fund dividend as Christopher Scott Mestis Tuck.
We've also filed a fraud complaint with the Permanent Fund Dividend Division with the state of Alaska for them to investigate whether or not he's illegally receiving his permanent fund.
Court records show Tuck started the process to change his name but didn't finish.
It's very disturbing that Mr. Mestis looks like he's hiding from something. It's just a matter of what he's trying to hide from.
They know me as Chris Tuck. Instead, they try to bring up a painful, hurtful past of my mother and my family, and that's despicable.
His biological father abandoned the family when he was an infant. He took the name of his stepfather when his mother remarried.
My Social Security is under Tuck. My electrical license is under Tuck. I went through the Anchorage School District system as Tuck and graduated and got a diploma from Diamond High School in 1984 as Tuck. And my banking accounts all Tuck.
He says the protest is not so much about his name as it is about party politics and methods. The Division of Election has until October 27th to announce its decision. This is Len Anderson.
A new regulation will go into effect early next year that requires many Alaskans to get something called the Transportation Worker Identification Credential. From Homer, Mike Mason reports.
The Transportation Worker Identification Credential, or TWIC, was mandated by Congress, and it's given to people who need unescorted access to secure areas of facilities and vessels. It's also mandatory for all mariners holding Coast Guard-issued credentials or qualification documents. Petty Officer Sarah Francis is the spokesperson for the Coast Guard District 17. She says not only do many workers need the cards by February the 12th, but also the cards must be activated by that date.
It's a two-part process. You enroll for your card and receive it. Then you need to take it back into a TWIC facility to get it activated. They do that for security. That way, if for some reason the card didn't get to the right place, not just anyone has access. Only the card holder can activate it.
The compliance date for workers is February the 12th, but the compliance date for mariners remains April 15th. Francis confirms that Alaska is full of designated secure areas that are regulated under the Maritime Transportation Security Act, including the Port of Anchorage, cruise ship terminals, and several other areas on the Kenai Peninsula and Kodiak Island.
The ferry terminals in Seward, we have the cruise ship dock and the coal facility. In Homer, there's also a cruise ship terminal. And in Nikiski, certainly, we have the pipeline docks there. And the Agrium facility. Those would all be secure facilities.
In order to get a TWIC card, you need to provide valid identification and go through a background check. The Coast Guard confirms that the TWIC is a biometric identification card that features an embedded chip that contains the bearer's photograph, fingerprints, and personal identification number. Francis says only about half of those in Alaska who need the card have so far applied for it.
To date, we have 6,539 applications in the system. And what we want to do is reach out and make sure everyone who needs this card recognizes that they need it. If you work on the port all the time as a longshoreman or you are constantly at the cruise ship facility, you recognize that you need this card. But some of the people who might be forgotten are, say, a crane mechanic, a crane operator, who only comes to the port maybe 30 days a year, but if he's there at the port, he has to be escorted. Some of those people may not realize that this is actually a benefit to them.
There are currently four permanent TWIC enrollment centers located in Anchorage, Nikiski, Juneau, and Valdez, and mobile enrollment centers have been opened in Ketchikan, Sitka, Dutch Harbor, Petersburg, Wrangell, Skagway, Cordova, and Haines. Francis says the Coast Guard and the Transportation Security Administration are looking at ways to get TWIC cards to people who don't have the ability to get into a permanent or mobile TWIC enrollment center.
You can apply for your card at any TWIC facility. If you are a seasonal mariner and you spend your time down in the lower 48, you can apply for your card there. You just need to recognize that your card will come back to that facility. So we're looking at some measures to get people their cards if they apply for it one place and maybe that's not where they're going to come back to.
Individuals in Alaska can pre-enroll for their TWIC card online at tsa.gov/TWIC or on the Coast Guard's home port site at homeport.uscg.mil. In Homer, I'm Mike Mason.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Mike Mason in Homer. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Alaska Quarterly Review is recognized as one of the nation's best literary magazines. Among the features of the 2008 issue is Joshua Castile's play Returns, about the war in Iraq from Castile's unique perspective as an interrogator and Arabic interpreter at Abu Ghraib Prison. Copies are available at select bookstores or by subscription. Alaska Quarterly Review is edited by Ronald Spatz and published by the University of Alaska Anchorage. This message sponsored by UAA. The 8th Annual Aviation North Expo is happening at the Fairbanks Princess Riverside Lodge October 16th through the 18th. This three-day aviation conference features travel and lodging discounts, FAA certification, a trade show, and networking opportunities. For details and to register, visit aviationnorth.org or call toll-free 877-427-5599. This message sponsored by the Aviation North Expo.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.